This is Audible Kids.
Audio Renaissance presents Gilead by Marilyn Robinson. Read for you by Tim Jerome.
I told you last night that I might be gone sometime. And you said, where? And I said, to be with the good Lord. And you said, why? And I said, because I'm old. And you said, I don't think you're old. And you put your hand in my hand, and you said, you aren't very old, as if that settled it. I told you you might have a very different life from mine, and from the life you've had with me. And that would be a wonderful thing. There are many ways to live a good life. And you said, Mama already told me that. And then you said, don't laugh, because you thought I was laughing at you. You reached up and put your fingers on my lips and gave me that look I never in my life saw on any other face besides your mother's. It's a kind of furious pride, very passionate and stern. I'm always a little surprised to find my eyebrows unsinged after I've suffered one of those looks. I will miss them. It seems ridiculous to suppose the dead miss anything. If you're a grown man when you read this, it is my intention for this letter that you will read it then. I'll have been gone a long time. I'll know most of what there is to know about being dead, but I'll probably keep it to myself. That seems to be the way of things. I don't know how many times people have asked me what death is like. Sometimes when they were only an hour or two from finding out for themselves. Even when I was a very young man, people as old as I am now would ask me, hold on to my hands and look into my eyes with their old milky eyes, as if they knew I knew, and they were going to make me tell them. I used to say it was like going home. We have no home in this world, I used to say. And then I'd walk back up the road to this old place and make myself a pot of coffee and a fried egg sandwich and listen to the radio when I got one, in the dark, as often as not. Do you remember this house? I think you must, a little. I grew up in parsonages. I've lived in this one most of my life, and I've visited a good many others because my father's friends and most of our relatives also lived in parsonages. And when I thought about it in those days, which wasn't too often, I thought this was the worst of them all, the draftiest and the dreariest. Well, that was my state of mind at the time. It's a perfectly good old house, but I was all alone in it then. And that made it seem strange to me. I didn't feel very much at home in the world. That was a fact. Now I do. And now they say my heart is failing. The doctor used the term angina pectoris, which has a theological sound like misericordia. Well, you expect these things at my age. My father died an old man. But his sisters didn't live very long, really. So I can only be grateful. I do regret that I have almost nothing to leave you and your mother. A few old books no one else would want. I never made any money to speak of. And I never paid any attention to the money I had. It was the furthest thing from my mind that I'd be leaving a wife and child, believe me. I'd have been a better father if I'd known. I'd have set something by for you. That is the main thing I want to tell you, that I regret very deeply the hard times I know you and your mother must have gone through, with no real help from me at all except my prayers. And I pray all the time. I did when I lived, and I do now, too, if that is how things are in the next life. I can hear you talking with your mother, you asking, she answering. It's not the words I hear, just the sounds of your voices. You don't like to go to sleep, and every night she has to sort of talk you into it all over again. I never hear her sing, except at night, from the next room, when she's coaxing you to sleep. And then I can't make out what song it is she's singing. Her voice is very low. Sounds beautiful to me. But she laughs when I say that. I really can't tell what's beautiful anymore. I passed two young fellows on the street the other day. I know who they are. They work at the garage. They're not church-going, either one of them. Just decent, rascally young fellows who have to be joking all the time. And there they were, propped against the garage wall in the sunshine, lighting up their cigarettes. They're always so black with grease and so strong with gasoline, I don't know why they don't catch fire themselves. They were passing remarks back and forth the way they do, and laughing that wicked way they have, and it seemed beautiful to me. It is an amazing thing to watch people laugh, the way it sort of takes them over. Sometimes they really do struggle with it. I see that in church often enough. So I wonder what it is and where it comes from. And I wonder what it expends out of your system, so that you have to do it till you're done. Like crying, in a way, I suppose. Except that laughter is much more easily spent. When they saw me coming, of course, the joking stopped. But I could see they were still laughing to themselves, thinking what the old preacher almost heard them say. I felt like telling them I appreciate a joke as much as anybody. There have been many occasions in my life when I have wanted to say that. But it's not a thing people are willing to accept. They want you to be a little bit apart. I felt like saying, I'm a dying man, and I won't have so many more occasions to laugh in this world, at least. But that would just make them serious and polite, I suppose. I'm keeping my condition a secret as long as I can. For a dying man, I feel pretty good, and that is a blessing. Of course, your mother knows about it. She said if I feel good, maybe the doctor is wrong. But at my age, there's a limit to how wrong he can be. That's the strangest thing about this life, about being in the ministry. People change the subject when they see you coming. And then sometimes those very same people come into your study and tell you the most remarkable things. There's a lot under the surface of life, everyone knows that. A lot of malice and dread and guilt, and so much loneliness, where you wouldn't really expect to find it, either. My mother's father was a preacher, and my father's father was, too, and his father before him, and before that, nobody knows, but I wouldn't hesitate to guess. That life was second nature to them, just as it is to me. They were fine people, but if there was one thing I should have learned from them and did not learn, it was to control my temper. This is wisdom I should have attained a long time ago. Even now, when a flutter of my pulse makes me think of final things, I find myself losing my temper because a drawer sticks or because I misplaced my glasses. I tell you so that you can watch for this in yourself. A little too much anger, too often or at the wrong time, can destroy more than you would ever imagine. Above all, mind what you say. Behold how much wood is kindled by how small a fire, and the tongue is a fire. That's the truth. When my father was old, he told me that very thing in a letter he sent me, which, as it happens, I burned. I dropped it right in the stove. This surprised me a good deal more at the time than it does in retrospect. I believe I'll make an experiment with candor here. Now I say this with all respect. My father was a man who acted from principle, as he said himself. He acted from faithfulness to the truth as he saw it. But something in the way he went about it made him disappointing from time to time, and not just to me. I say this despite all the attention he gave me bringing me up, for which I am profoundly in his debt, though he himself might dispute that. God rest his soul, I know for a fact I disappointed him. It is a remarkable thing to consider. We meant well by each other, too. Well, see and see, but do not perceive. Hear and hear, but do not understand, as the Lord says. I can't claim to understand that saying, as many times as I've heard it, and even preached on it. It simply states a deeply mysterious fact. You can know a thing to death and be, for all purposes, completely ignorant of it. A man can know his father or his son, and there might be still nothing between them but loyalty and love and mutual incomprehension. My point in mentioning this is only to say that people who feel any sort of regret where you are concerned will suppose you are angry, and they will see anger in what you do, even if you are just quietly going about a life of your own choosing. They make you doubt yourself, which, depending on cases, can be a severe distraction and a waste of time. This is a thing I wish I had understood much earlier than I did. Just to reflect on it makes me a little irritated. Irritation is a form of anger, I recognize that. One great benefit of a religious vocation is that it helps you concentrate. It gives you a good basic sense of what is being asked of you, and also what you might as well ignore. If I have any wisdom to offer, this is a fair part of it. You have blessed our house not quite 7 years, and fairly lean years, too, so late in my life. There was no way for me to make any changes to provide for the two of you. Still, I think about it, and I pray. It is very much in my mind. I want you to know that. We're having a fine spring, and this is another fine day. You were almost late for school. We stood you on a chair, and you ate toast and jam while your mother polished your shoes and I combed your hair. You had a page of sums to do that you should have done last night, and you took forever over them this morning, trying to get all the numbers facing the right way. You're like your mother, so serious about everything. The old men call you deacon, but that seriousness isn't all from my side of the family. I've never seen anything like it until I met her. Well, putting aside my grandfather, it seemed to me to be half sadness and half fury, and I wondered what in her life could have put that expression in her eyes. And then, when you were about 3, just a little fellow, I came into the nursery one morning, and there you were, down on the floor in the sunlight in your trapdoor pajamas, trying to figure out a way to fix a broken crayon. And you looked up at me, and it was just that look of hers. I've thought of that moment many times. I'll tell you, sometimes it has seemed to me that you were looking back through life, back through troubles I pray you'll never have, asking me to kindly explain myself. "You're just like all them old men in the Bible," your mother tells me. And that would be true if I could manage to live 120 years, and maybe have a few cattle and oxen and men-servants and maid-servants. My father left me a trade, which happened also to be my vocation. But the fact is, it was all second nature to me. I grew up with it. Most likely, you will not. I saw a bubble float past my window, fat and wobbly and ripening toward that dragonfly blue they turn just before they burst. I looked down at the yard, and there you were, you and your mother, blowing bubbles at the cat. Such a barrage of them that the poor beast was beside herself at the glut of opportunity. She was actually leaping in the air, our insouciant Soapy. Some of the bubbles drifted up through the branches, even above the trees. You two were too intent on the cat to see the celestial consequences of your worldly endeavors. They were very lovely. Your mother is wearing her blue dress, and you are wearing your red shirt, and you are kneeling on the ground together with Soapy between you, and that effulgence of bubbles rising, and so much laughter. Ah, this life, this world. Your mother told you I'm writing your begats, and you seemed very pleased with the idea. Well then, what should I record for you? I, John Ames, was born in the year of our Lord 1880 in the state of Kansas, the son of John Ames and Martha Turner Ames, grandson of John Ames and Margaret Todd Ames. At this writing, I have lived 76 years. 74 of them here in Gilead, Iowa, accepting study at the college and at seminary. What else should I tell you? When I was 12 years old, my father took me to the grave of my grandfather. At that time, my family had been living in Gilead for about 10 years, my father serving the church here. His father, who was born in Maine, had come out to Kansas in the 1830s, lived with us for a number of years after his retirement. Then the old man ran off to become a sort of itinerant preacher, or so we believed. He died in Kansas and was buried there, near a town that had pretty well lost its people. A drought had driven most of them away, those who had not already left for towns closer to the railroad. Surely there was only a town in that place to begin with, because it was Kansas, and the people who settled it were free soilers who weren't really thinking about the long term. I don't often use the expression God-forsaken, but when I think back to that place, that word does come to mind. It took my father months to find where the old man had ended up. Lots of letters of inquiry to churches and newspapers and so on. He put a great deal of effort into it. Finally, someone wrote back and sent a little package with his watch and a beat-up old Bible and some letters, which I learned later were just a few of my father's letters of inquiry, no doubt given to the old man by people who thought they had induced him to come home. It grieved my father bitterly that the last words he said to my father were very angry words, and there could never be any reconciliation between them in this life. He did truly honor his father, generally speaking, and it was hard for him to accept that things should have ended the way they did. That was in 1892, so travel was still pretty hard. We went as far as we could by train, and then my father hired a wagon and team. That was more than we needed, but it was all we could find. We took some bad directions and got lost, and we had so much trouble keeping the horses watered that we boarded them at a farmstead and went the rest of the way on foot. The roads were terrible anyway, swamped in dust where they were traveled and baked into ruts where they were not. My father was carrying some tools in a gunny sack so he could try to put the grave to rights a little, and I was carrying what we had for food, hardtack and jerky and the few little yellow apples we picked up along the road here and there, and our changes of shirts and socks, all by then filthy. He didn't really have enough money to make the trip at that time, but it was so much in his thoughts that he couldn't wait until he had saved up for it. I told him I had to go, too, and he respected that, though it did make many things harder. My mother had been reading about how bad the drought was west of us, and she was not happy at all when he said he planned to take me along. He told her it would be educational, and it surely was. My father was set on finding that grave despite any hardship. Never before in my life had I wondered where I would come by my next drink of water, and I number it among my blessings that I have not had occasion to wonder since. There were times when I truly believed we might just wander off and die. Once, when my father was gathering sticks for firewood into my arms, he said we were like Abraham and Isaac on the way to Mount Moriah. I thought as much myself. It was so bad out there we couldn't buy food. We stopped at a farmstead and asked the lady, and she took a little bundle down from a cupboard and showed us some coins and bills and said, "It might as well be Confederate for all the good it does me." The general store had closed, and she couldn't get salt or sugar or flour. We traded her some of our miserable jerky. I've never been able to stand the sight of it since then. For 2 boiled eggs and 2 boiled potatoes, which tasted wonderful even without salt. Then my father asked after his father, and she said, why, yes, he'd been in the neighborhood. She didn't know he had died, but she knew where he was likely to have been buried, and she showed us to what remained of a road that would take us right to the place, not 3 miles from where we stood. The road was overgrown, but as you walked along, you could see the ruts. The brush grew lower in them, because the earth was still packed so hard. We walked past that graveyard twice. The 2 or 3 headstones in it had fallen over, and it was all grown up with weeds and grass. The third time, my father noticed a fence post, so we walked over to it, and we could see a handful of graves, a row of maybe 7 or 8, and below it a half row, swamped with that dead brown grass. I remember that the incompleteness of it seemed sad to me. In the second row, we found a marker someone had made by stripping a patch of bark off a log and then driving nails partway in and bending them down flat so they made the letters R-E-V-A-M-E-S. The R looked like the A and the S was a backward Z, but there was no mistaking it. It was evening by then, so we walked back to the lady's farm and washed at her cistern and drank from her well and slept in her hayloft. She brought us a supper of cornmeal mush. I loved that woman like a second mother. I loved her to the point of tears. We were up before daylight to milk and cut kindling and draw her a bucket of water, and she met us at the door with a breakfast of fried mush with blackberry preserves melted over it, and a spoonful of top milk on it. And we ate standing there at the stoop in the chill and the dark, and it was perfectly wonderful. Then we went back to the graveyard, which was just a patch of ground with a half-fallen fence around it and a gate on a chain weighted with a cowbell. My father and I fixed up the fence as best we could. He broke up the ground on the grave a little with his jackknife, but then he decided we should go back to the farmhouse again to borrow a couple of hoes and make a better job of it. He said we might as well look after these other folks while we're here. This time the lady had a dinner of navy beans waiting for us. I don't remember her name, which seems a pity. She had an index finger which was off at the first knuckle, and she spoke with a lisp. She seemed old to me at the time, but I think she was just a country woman trying to keep her manners and her sanity, trying to keep alive, weary as could be, and all by herself out there. My father said she spoke as if her people might be from Maine, but he didn't ask her. She cried when we said goodbye to her and wiped her face with her apron. My father asked if there was a letter or a message she would like us to carry back with us, and she said no. He asked if she would like to come along, and she thanked us and shook her head and said, "There's the cow." She said, "We'll be fine when the rain comes." That graveyard was about the loneliest place you could imagine. If I were to say it was going back to nature, you might get the idea that there was some sort of vitality about the place. But it was parched and sun-stricken. It was hard to imagine the grass had ever been green. Everywhere you stepped, little grasshoppers would fly up by the score, making that snap they do like striking a match. My father put his hands in his pockets, looked around and shook his head. Then he started cutting the brush back with a hand scythe he had brought, and we set up the markers that had fallen over. Most of the graves were just outlined with stones, with no names or dates or anything on them at all. My father said to be careful where I stepped. There were small graves here and there that I hadn't noticed at first, or I hadn't quite realized what they were. I certainly didn't want to walk on them, but until he cut the weeds down, I couldn't tell where they were. And then I knew I had stepped on some of them, and I felt sick. Only in childhood have I felt guilt like that and pity. I still dream about it. My father always said when someone dies, the body is just a suit of old clothes the spirit doesn't want anymore. But there we were, half killing ourselves to find a grave, and as cautious as we could be about where we put our feet. We worked a good deal at putting things to rights. It was hot, and there was such a sound of grasshoppers and of wind rattling that dry grass. Then we scattered seeds around, bee balm and cone flower and sunflower and bachelor's button and sweet pea. They were seeds we always saved out of our own garden. When we finished, my father sat down on the ground beside his father's grave. He stayed there for a good while, plucking at little whiskers of straw that still remained on it, fanning himself with his hat. I think he regretted that there was nothing more for him to do. Finally, he got up and brushed himself off, and we stood there, together with our miserable clothes all damp and our hands all dirty from the work, and the first crickets rasping and the flies really beginning to bother, and the birds crying out the way they do when they're about ready to settle for the night, and my father bowed his head and began to pray, remembering his father to the Lord, and also asking the Lord's pardon, and his father's as well. I missed my grandfather mightily, and I felt the need of pardon too, but that was a very long prayer. Every prayer seemed long to me at that age, and I was truly bone-tired. I tried to keep my eyes closed, but after a while I had to look around a little, and this is something I remember very well. At first I thought I saw the sun setting in the east. I knew where the east was, because the sun was just over the horizon when we got there that morning. Then I realized that what I saw was a full moon rising just as the sun was going down. Each of them was standing on its edge, with the most wonderful light between them. It seemed as if you could touch it, as if there were palpable currents of light passing back and forth, or as if there were great taut skeins of light suspended between them. I wanted my father to see it, but I knew I'd have to startle him out of his prayer, and I wanted to do it the best way, so I took his hand and kissed it. And then I said, "Look at the moon." And he did. We just stood there until the sun was down and the moon was up. They seemed to float on the horizon for quite a long time, I suppose because they were both so bright you couldn't get a clear look at them. And that grave, and my father and I, were exactly between them, which seemed amazing to me at the time, since I hadn't given much thought to the nature of the horizon. My father said, "I would never have thought this place could be so beautiful. I'm glad to know that." We looked so terrible when we finally got home that my mother just burst into tears at the sight of us. We'd both gotten thin, and our clothes were in bad shape. The whole journey didn't take quite a month, but we'd been sleeping in barns and sheds, and even on the bare ground during the week or so that we were actually lost. It was a great adventure to look back on, and my father and I used to laugh about some fairly dreadful things. An old man even took a shot at us once. My father was, as he said at the time, intending to glean a few overgrown carrots out of a garden we passed. He'd left a dime on the stoop to pay for whatever we could find to steal, which was always little enough. That was something to see, my father in his shirt sleeves straddling a rickety old garden fence with a hank of carrot tops in his hand, and a fellow behind him taking aim. We took off into the brush, and when we decided he wasn't going to follow us, we sat down on the ground and my father scraped the dirt off the carrot with his knife and cut it up into pieces and set them on the crown of his hat, which he'd put between us like a table, and then he commenced to say grace, which he never failed to do. He said, "For all we are about to receive." And then we both started laughing till the tears were pouring down. I realize now that keeping us fed was a desperate concern for him. It actually drove him to something resembling crime. That carrot was so big and old and tough, he had to whittle it into chips. It was about like eating a branch, and there was nothing to wash it down with either. I really only realized afterward what trouble I'd have been in if he had gotten shot, even killed, and I was left stranded on my own out there. I still dream about that. I think he felt the sort of shame you feel when you realize what a foolish chance you've taken after you've already taken it. But he was absolutely set on finding that grave. Once, to make a point that I should study while I was young and learning came easily, my grandfather told me about a man he knew when he first came to Kansas, a preacher newly settled there. He said, That fellow just was not confident of his Hebrew. He'd walk 15 miles across open country in the dead of winter to settle a point of interpretation. We'd have to thaw him out before he could tell us what it was he had on his mind. My father laughed and said, "The strange part is, that may even be true." But I remembered the story at the time, because it seemed to me we were doing something very similar. My father gave up gleaning and went back to knocking on doors, which he had been reluctant to do, because when people found out he was a preacher, they would sometimes try to give us more than they could spare. That was his belief, at least. And they could tell he was a preacher. Rough-looking as we were a few days into our desert wanderings, as he called them. We offered to do some chores in exchange for food at a couple of houses, and the people asked him if he would just open a bit of scripture or say a prayer. He was interested that they knew, and wondered a good deal what it was that gave him away. It was a matter of pride with him that his hands were hard, and that there was no spare flesh on him to speak of. I have had the same experience many times, and I have wondered about it, too. Well, we spent a good many days on the edge of disaster, and we laughed about it for years. It was always the worst parts that made us laugh. My mother was irked by it all, but she just said, "Don't you ever tell me." In many ways, she was a remarkably careful mother, poor woman. I was in a sense her only child. Before I was born, she had bought herself a new home health care book. It was large and expensive, and it was a good deal more particular than Leviticus. On its authority, she tried to keep us from making any use of our brains for an hour after supper, or from reading at all when our feet were cold. The idea was to prevent conflicting demands on the circulation of the blood. My grandfather told her once that if you couldn't read with cold feet, there wouldn't be a literate soul in the state of Maine. But she was very serious about these things, and he only irritated her. She said, "Nobody in Maine gets much of anything to eat, so it all comes out even." When I got home, she scrubbed me down and put me to bed and fed me 6 or 7 times a day and forbade me the use of my brain after every single meal. The tedium was considerable. That journey was a great blessing to me. I realize, looking back, how young my father was then. He couldn't have been much more than 45 or 6. He was a fine, vigorous man into his old age. We played catch in the evenings after supper for years, till the sun went down and it was too dark for us to see the ball. I think he just appreciated having a child at home, a son. Well, I was a fine, vigorous old man, too, until recently. You know, I suppose, that I married a girl when I was young. We had grown up together. We were married during my last year at seminary, and then we came back here so I could take my father's pulpit while he and my mother went south for a few months for the sake of my mother's health. Well, my wife died in childbirth, and the child died with her. Their names were Louisa and Angeline. I saw the baby while she lived, and I held her for a few minutes, and that was a blessing. Boughton baptized her, and he gave her the name Angeline, because I was over in Tabor for the day. The child was not expected for another 6 weeks, and there was no one to tell him what name we had finally decided on. She'd have been Rebecca, but Angeline is a good name. Last Sunday, when we went to Boughton's for supper, I saw you looking at his hands. They are so full of arthritis now that they're all skin and knuckles. You think he's terribly old, and he's younger than I am. He was best man at my first wedding, and he married me and your mother. His daughter, Glory, is home with him now. Her marriage failed, and that is a sad thing. But it is a blessing for Boughton to have her here. She came by the other day to bring me a magazine. She told me Jack might be coming home, too. It actually took me a minute to think who that was. You probably don't remember much about old Boughton. He is a little cross now from time to time, which is understandable considering his discomfort. It would be a pity if that is what you remembered of him. In his prime, he was as fine a preacher as I ever heard. My father always preached from notes, and I wrote my sermons out word for word. There are boxes of them in the attic, a few recent years of them in stacks in the closet. I've never gone back to them to see if they were worth anything, if I actually said anything. Pretty nearly my whole life's work is in those boxes, which is an amazing thing to reflect on. I could look through them, maybe find a few I would want you to have. I'm a little afraid of them. I believe I may have worked over them as I did just to keep myself occupied. If someone came to the house and found me writing, generally he or she would go away, unless it was something pretty important. I don't know why solitude would be a balm for loneliness, but that is how it always was for me in those days, and people respected me for all those hours I was up here working away in the study, and for the books that used to come in the mail for me. Not so many, really, but more than I could afford. That's where some of the money went that I could have put aside. There was more to it, of course. For me, writing has always felt like praying, even when I wasn't writing prayers, as I was often enough. You feel that you are with someone. I feel I am with you now, whatever that can mean, considering that you're only a little fellow now, and when you're a man, you might find these letters of no interest. Or they might never reach you, for any of a number of reasons. Well, but how deeply I regret any sadness you have suffered, and how grateful I am in anticipation of any good you have enjoyed. That is to say, I pray for you, and there's an intimacy in it. That's the truth. Your mother is respectful of my hours up here in the study. She's proud of my books. She was the one who actually called my attention to the number of boxes I have filled with my sermons and my prayers. Say 50 sermons a year for 45 years, not counting funerals and so on, of which there have been a great many. 2,250. If they average 30 pages, that's 67,500 pages. Can that be right? I guess it is. I write in a small hand, too, as you know by now. Say 300 pages make a volume, then I've written 225 books, which puts me up there with Augustine and Calvin for quantity. That's amazing. I wrote almost all of it in the deepest hope and conviction. Sifting my thoughts and choosing my words, trying to say what was true. And I'll tell you frankly, that was wonderful. I'm grateful for all those dark years, even though in retrospect they seem like a long, bitter prayer that was answered finally. Your mother walked into church in the middle of the prayer, to get out of the weather, I thought at the time, because it was pouring, and she watched me with eyes so serious I was embarrassed to be preaching to her. As Boughton would say, I felt the poverty of my remarks. Sometimes I have loved the peacefulness of an ordinary Sunday. It is like standing in a newly planted garden after a warm rain. You can feel the silent and invisible life. All it needs from you is that you take care not to trample on it. And that was such a quiet day. Rain on the roof, rain against the windows, and everyone grateful, since it seems we never do have quite enough rain. At times like that, I might not care particularly whether people are listening to whatever I have to say, because I know what their thoughts are. Then, if some stranger comes in, that very same peace can seem like somnolence and like dull habit, because that is how you're afraid it seems to her. If Rebecca had lived, she'd be 51, older than your mother is now by 10 years. For a long time, I used to think how it would be if she walked in that door. What I would not be ashamed, at least, to say in her hearing, because I always imagined her coming back from a place where everything is known, and hearing my hopes and my speculations the way someone would who has seen the truth face to face and would know the full measure of my incomprehension. That was a sort of trick I played on myself, to keep from taking doctrines and controversies too much to heart. I read so many books in those days, and I was always disputing them in my mind with one or another of them, but I think I usually knew better than to take too much of that sort of thing into the pulpit. I believe, though, that it was because I wrote those sermons as if Rebecca might sometime walk in the door that I was somewhat prepared when your mother walked in. Younger than Rebecca would have been, in fact, of course, but not very different from the way I saw her in my mind. It wasn't so much her appearance as it was the way she seemed as if she didn't belong there, and at the same time, as if she were the only one of us all who really did belong there. I say this because there was a seriousness about her that seemed almost like a kind of anger, as though she might say, I came here from whatever unspeakable distance and from whatever unimaginable otherness just to oblige your prayers. Now say something with a little meaning in it. My sermon was like ashes on my tongue, and it wasn't that I hadn't worked on it either. I worked on all my sermons. I remember I baptized 2 infants that day. I could feel how intensely she watched. Both the creatures wept when I touched the water to their heads the first time, and I looked up, and there was just the look of stern amazement in her face that I knew would be there even before I looked up, and I felt like saying quite sincerely, "If you know a better way to do this, I'd appreciate your telling me." Then, just 6 months later, I baptized her, and I felt like asking her, "What have I done? What does it mean?" That was a question that came to me often, not because I felt less than certain I had done something that did mean something, but because no matter how much I thought and read and prayed, I felt outside the mystery of it. The tears ran down her face, dear woman. I'll never forget that. Unless I forget everything, as so many of the old people do. It appears I at least won't live long enough to forget much I haven't forgotten already, which is a good deal, I know. I have thought about baptism over the years. Bowden and I have discussed it often. Now, this might seem a trivial thing to mention, considering the gravity of the subject, but I truly don't feel it is. We were very pious children, from pious households, in a fairly pious town. And this affected our behavior considerably. Once we baptized a litter of cats. They were dusty little barn cats, just steady on their legs, the kind of waifish creatures that live their anonymous lives keeping the mice down, and have no interest in humans at all, except to avoid them. But the animals all seemed to start out sociable, so we were always pleased to find new kittens prowling out of whatever cranny their mother had tried to hide them in, as ready to play as we were. It occurred to one of the girls to swaddle them up in a doll's dress. There was only one dress, which was just as well, since the cats could hardly tolerate a moment in it, and would have to have been unswaddled as soon as they were christened in any case. I myself moistened their brows, repeating the full Trinitarian formula. Their grim, old, crook-tailed mother found us baptizing away by the creek and began carrying her babies off by the napes of their necks, one and then another. We lost track of which was which, but we were fairly sure that some of the creatures had been borne away still in the darkness of paganism, and that worried us a good deal. So finally I asked my father, in the most offhand way imaginable, what exactly would happen to a cat if one were to, say, baptize it. He replied that the sacraments must always be treated and regarded with the greatest respect. That wasn't really an answer to my question. We did respect the sacraments, but we thought the whole world of those cats. I got his meaning, though, and I did no more baptizing until I was ordained. 2 or 3 of that litter were taken home by the girls and made into fairly respectable house cats. Louisa took a yellow one. She still had it when we were married. The others lived out their feral lives, indistinguishable from their kind, whether pagan or Christian, no one could ever tell. She called her cat Sparkle for the white patch on its forehead. It disappeared finally. I suspect it got caught stealing rabbits, a sin to which it was much given, Christian cat though we knew it to be, stiff-jointed as it was by that time. One of the boys said she should have named it Sprinkle. He was a Baptist, a firm believer in total immersion, which those cats should have been grateful I was not. He told us no effect at all could be achieved by our methods, and we could not prove him wrong. Our Soapy must be a distant relative. I still remember how those warm little brows felt under the palm of my hand. Everyone has petted a cat, but to touch one like that, with the pure intention of blessing it, is a very different thing. It stays in the mind. For years we would wonder what, from a cosmic viewpoint, we had done to them. It still seems to me to be a real question. There is a reality in blessing, which I take baptism to be primarily. It doesn't enhance sacredness, but it acknowledges it, and there is a power in that. I have felt it pass through me, so to speak. The sensation is of really knowing a creature. I mean really feeling its mysterious life and your own mysterious life at the same time. I don't wish to be urging the ministry on you, but there are some advantages to it you might not know to take account of if I did not point them out. Not that you have to be a minister to confer blessing. You are simply much more likely to find yourself in that position. It's a thing people expect of you. I don't know why there is so little about this aspect of the calling in the literature. Ludwig Feuerbach says a wonderful thing about baptism. I have it marked. He says, water is the purest, clearest of liquids. In virtue of this its natural character, it is the image of the spotless nature of the divine spirit. In short, water has a significance in itself as water. It is on account of its natural quality that it is consecrated and selected as the vehicle of the Holy Spirit. So far there lies at the foundation of baptism a beautiful, profound, natural significance. Feuerbach is a famous atheist, but he is about as good on the joyful aspects of religion as anybody, and he loves the world. Of course, he thinks religion could just stand out of the way and let joy exist pure and undisguised. That is his one error, and it is significant. But he is marvelous on the subject of joy, and also on its religious expressions. Boughton takes a very dim view of him, because he unsettled the faith of many people. But I take issue as much with those people as with Feuerbach. It seems to me some people just go around looking to get their faith unsettled. That has been the fashion for the last 100 years or so. My brother Edward gave his book to me, The Essence of Christianity, thinking to shock me out of my uncritical piety, as I knew at the time. I had to read it in secret, or so I believed. I put it in a biscuit tin and hid it in a tree. You can imagine, reading it in those circumstances gave it a great interest for me, and I was very much in awe of Edward, who had studied at a university in Germany. I realized I haven't even mentioned Edward, though he has been very important to me, as he is still, God rest his soul. I feel in some ways as if I hardly knew him, and in others, as if I have been talking to him my whole life. He thought he would do me a favor, taking a bit of the Middle West out of me. That was the favor Europe had done for him. But here I am, having lived to the end of the life he warned me against, and pretty well content with it, too, all in all. Still, I know I am touchy on the subject of parochialism. Edward studied in Göttingen. He was a remarkable man. He was older than me by almost 10 years, so I really didn't know him very well while we were children. There were 2 sisters and a brother between us, all carried off by diphtheria in less than 2 months. He knew them, and I, of course, did not, So that was another great difference. Though it was rarely spoken of, I was always aware that there had been a crowded, cheerful life the three of them remembered well, and I could not really imagine. In any case, Edward left home at 16 to go to college. He finished at 19 with a degree in ancient languages and went straight off to Europe. None of us saw him again for years. There weren't even many letters. Then he came home with a walking stick and a huge mustache. Herr Doctor. He must have been about 27 or 28. He had published a slender book in German, a monograph of some kind on Feuerbach. He was smart as could be, and my father was a little in awe of him, too, as he had been since Edward was a small boy, I think. My parents told me stories about how he read everything he could put his hands on, memorized a whole book of Longfellow, copied maps of Europe and Asia, and learned all the cities and rivers. Of course, they thought they were bringing up a little Samuel. So did everyone. So they all kept him supplied with books and paints and a magnifying glass, and whatever else came to mind or to hand. My mother sometimes regretted out loud that they hadn't really required him to do much in the way of chores, and she certainly didn't make the same mistake with me. But a child as wonderful as he was is not a thing you see often, and the belief was general that he would be a great preacher. So the congregation took up collections to put him in college, and then to send him to Germany. And he came back an atheist. That's what he always claimed to be, at any rate. He took a position at the State College in Lawrence, teaching German literature and philosophy, and stayed there till he died. He married a German girl from Indianapolis, and they had six little tow-headed children, all of them well into middle age by now. He was a few hundred miles away all those years, and I hardly ever saw him. He did send back contributions to the church to repay them for helping him. A check dated January 1st came every year he lived. He was a good man. He and my father had words when he came back. Once at the dinner table that first evening when my father asked him to say grace. Edward cleared his throat and replied, "I am afraid I could not do that in good conscience, sir." And the color drained out of my father's face. I knew there had been letters I was not given to read, and there had been somber words between my parents, so this was the dreaded confirmation of their fears. My father said, "You have lived under this roof. You know the customs of your family. You might show some respect for them." And Edward replied, and this was very wrong of him, "When I was a child, I thought as a child. Now that I am become a man, I have put away childish things." My father left the table. My mother sat still in her chair, with tears streaming down her face, and Edward passed me the potatoes. I had no idea what was expected of me, so I took some. Edward passed me the gravy. We ate our unhallowed meal solemnly for a little while, and then we left the house, and I walked Edward to the hotel. And on that walk he said to me, "John, you might as well know now what you're sure to learn sometime. This is a backwater. You must be aware of that already. Leaving here is like waking from a trance." I suppose the neighbors saw us leaving the house just at dinner time that first day. Edward, with one arm bent behind his back, stooped a little to suggest that he had some use for a walking stick, appearing somehow to be plunged in thought of an especially rigorous and distinguished kind, possibly conducted in a foreign language. Only listen to me. If they saw him, they'd have known instantly what they had long suspected. They'd have known also that there was rage and weeping in my mother's kitchen, and that my father was in the attic or the woodshed in some hidden, quiet place, down on his knees, wondering to the Lord what it was that was being asked of him. And there I was with Edward, trailing along after him. Another grief to my parents, or so they must have thought. Besides those books I mentioned, Edward also gave me the little painting of a marketplace that hangs by the stairs. I must be sure to tell your mother it belongs to me and not to the parsonage. I doubt it's worth anything to speak of, but she might want it. I'm going to set aside that Feuerbach with the books I will ask your mother to be sure to save for you. I hope you will read it sometime. There is nothing alarming in it, to my mind. I read it the first time under the covers and down by the creek because my mother had forgiven me to have any further contact with Edward. And I knew that would include my reading an atheistical book he had given me. She said, "If you ever spoke to your father that way, it would kill him." In fact, my thought was always to defend my father. I believe I have done that. There are some notes of mine in the margins of the book which I hope you may find useful. That mention of Feuerbach and joy reminded me of something I saw early one morning a few years ago as I was walking up to the church. There was a young couple strolling along half a block ahead of me. The sun had come up brilliantly after a heavy rain, and the trees were glistening and very wet. On some impulse, plain exuberance, I suppose, the fellow jumped up and caught hold of a branch, and a storm of luminous water came pouring down on the two of them. And they laughed and took off running, the girl sweeping water off her hair and her dress as if she were a little bit disgusted. But she wasn't. It was a beautiful thing to see, like something from a myth. I don't know why I thought of that now, except perhaps because it is easy to believe in some moments that water was made primarily for blessing and only secondarily for growing vegetables or doing the wash. I wish I had paid more attention to it. My list of regrets may seem unusual, but who can know that they are, really? This is an interesting planet. It deserves all the attention you can give it. In writing this, I noticed the care it costs me not to use certain words more than I ought to. I am thinking about the word just. I almost wish I could have written that the sun just shone, and the tree just glistened, and the water just poured out of it, and the girl just laughed. When it's used that way, it does indicate a stress on the word that follows it, and also a particular pitch of the voice. People talk that way when they want to call attention to a thing existing in excess of itself, so to speak, a sort of purity or lavishness, at any rate something ordinary in kind but exceptional in degree. So it seems to me at the moment. There is something real signified by that word just that proper language won't acknowledge. It's a little like the German ge. I regret that I must deprive myself of it. It takes half the point out of telling the story. I am also inclined to overuse the word old, which actually has less to do with age, as it seems to me, than it does with familiarity. It sets a thing apart as something regarded with a modest, habitual affection. Sometimes it suggests haplessness or vulnerability. I say old Bauten. I say this shabby old town. And I mean that they are very near my heart. I don't write the way I speak. I'm afraid you would think I didn't know any better. I don't write the way I do for the pulpit, either, insofar as I can help it. That would be ridiculous in the circumstances. I do try to write the way I think, but of course that all changes as soon as I put it into words. And the more it does seem to be my thinking, the more pulpitish it sounds, which I guess is inevitable. I will resist that inflection, nevertheless. I walked over to Bowden's to see what he was up to. I found him in a terrible state of mind. Tomorrow would have been his 54th anniversary. He said, "The truth is, I'm just very tired of sitting here alone. That's the truth." Glory is there, doing everything she can think of to make him comfortable, but he has his bad days. He said, "When we were young, marriage meant something. Family meant something. Things weren't at all the way they are today." Glory rolled her eyes.